Hi, folks, this is Jack Spearco with another edition of the Survival Podcast. It's always one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life. If times get tough, or even if they don't, today is, well, it's January the 6th, 2025. So I guess we're going to have an insurrection today. No, we're not. We're not going to talk about any of that crap today at all. Actually, today is going to be a little bit of an audible, but a new episode in that I was asked to do a presentation for a really great seminar that Matt Powers runs every year, but I was kind of asked toward the last minute, and actually due to my own scheduling conflicts in my head, I thought it needed to be available today, and I actually had till Wednesday. So I actually did a presentation for Matt's Our Soil conference, which I really recommend that you register for. Especially because I have a pretty interesting PowerPoint deck that goes along with what you're about to hear, and you won't get it presented with the deck unless you register for Our Soil. By the way, Our Soil is free. You get 2 additional days after the conference ends to watch all the videos that you did not see. If you want replay into the future with it, it's a small charge. I think it's $40 or something like that. But it's going to be a great conference. There's going to be some really amazing presenters, people that have been on the air as well with me, like Zach Weiss and Steven Reisner, of course, Matt Powers, and many other really amazing teachers. And the days are lined up as follows. The first day is on biofertilizer and biologics, and that is the day that I'm speaking on what you're about to hear. This starts on Wednesday this week, and that's on compost, char and cover crops, build, increase, and hold in your soil fertility. Plus, there's another just huge lineup of great speakers there. Then on Thursday, which is the 9th, the whole day is really kind of dedicated toward the mycology side of things. Day 3 is more toward the composting side of things. Day 4, which is going to be more about regenerative ag. And then day 5 will be entrepreneurship. Odds are I'll end up on a panel. Matt always asks last minute, so that'll probably happen. But what you're about to hear again is the audio from my presentation on compost, biochar, and cover crops. And hopefully that will make a good first real official day back to the Survival Podcast. As for me, what am I going to be doing today? I actually, my wife had told me about this. This is my fault. I didn't put it on the calendar. My niece slash goddaughter is in town for a couple more days from the holidays, and we're going to go have lunch with her and her husband. And I get to see her very infrequently now. As you know, she was my goddaughter, and we live close and all. I watched her grow up. She's a wonderful young woman now. She graduated from Texas A&M a couple years ago. She now lives in Florida. Her husband is a staff sergeant in the Air Force, so I just don't get to see her much. So that will kind of do double duty today, stacking this in, but I still recommend that you consider registering for the Our Future, Our Soil Conference. The link is kind of long and clunky to do so it's in the show notes for you today. All you gotta do is look up today's episode and go click on it, and you can get over there and register for it. And next up, before we go ahead and drop you into that presentation, we'll let you know about a couple really cool classes I've been teasing for a while. They just officially dropped. Anybody that pre-emailed me and said, let me know before they go live, has already had a link sent. So if you didn't get it, I'm sorry. You want to jump on this right away. These will probably sell out pretty quick. The first one is a compost and biochar half-day class at my place here in Texas. Tentatively, we are doing that Saturday, January 25th, about 10:30 in the morning to 4:30 in the afternoon. We're going to build a couple bioreactors, go over the new models of reactor that I've developed, including the aging reactor. We're going to do a small biochar burn and have lots of Q&A and a good time and really good food. I'm going to serve lunch slash dinner. We'll call it linner because we're going to start about 10:30 in the morning, and we probably won't break till about 2:30. So make sure you power up with some kind of breakfast first if you need to do that. We'll have snacks and stuff out too, and coffee and everything, but we're not doing a breakfast. Lunch or linner, I guess, is going to be a flight of my homemade sausages, along with some smoked pork shoulder and a few surprises. Again, that's going to be January 25th. The one thing you need to know about it is that you need to be flexible with your date there. January 25th could be like today. If it's like today, we're moving it. Because today, it was 22 freaking degrees with a wind chill factor of 4. 4. We ain't doing that, okay? And the warmest it's going to get today is like 38 degrees with a wind chill down in the teens. We ain't doing that. It could also rain. It could ice. It could sleet. You get it. So this one is more for people, because it has to be done outside, who are somewhat local, couple 3-hour drive. You know, you could be flexible on it. And if you have to cancel because I changed the date, I will just refund your money. This class is only $50, and I think you will find it totally worth the money. And it's already about a third full just from pre-registration. Just saying. The next one is is also in Texas, but it's about an hour north of me. It's at a place called Crunchy Mama Farms. This is limited to only 18 attendees. It will be March 21 to 23rd. In this class, there will be 8 students per cow. I am not a student. I'm like an adjunctive instructor and just there to support the event. Chef Ken Daniels will be there. And let me tell you, I'm so glad I brought him to my workshop in November. This guy brings it. He is going to make things extra special for you while you're there. And Ken and I are doing that kind of as volunteers. We're taking nothing in return for it. We want to make this cool. We want to help out the folks at Crunchy Mama Farms, because they're just really great people. I really enjoyed hanging out with them here at the workshop. So an eighth of a cow per student is the meat you'll be taking home. Okay, so two teams of 8 students, instructors helping you. You will fully process beef all the way through, starting with a cow that is alive. Okay, you're not going to get a lot of opportunities like this. Is this cheap? No. It's a 3-day thing. It's $975. But again, you're going to leave with about 50 pounds of grass-fed beef in a cooler. If you say that's worth $8 a pound, knock the price in half right there. Here's the other thing. If you register more than 30 days in advance so that they can plan better, they'll take $100 off. It'll only be $875. That makes it an even better deal. So you get the experience, you get the networking, you get all of the education, plus you leave with about 50 pounds roughly of beef. Some of the beef will be used for dinners while we're there, so a little bit will come out for that. But overall, again, an eighth beef, plus the education for a little under $900 if you go ahead and register soon. I would, if you want to go to either of these classes, register. Their class will be primarily inside since it's butchering, and so we won't have much of a weather problem. Plus, it's late March in North Texas. It's pretty beautiful that time of year, except for the occasional storm. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and drop in. Again, this presentation that I've done for Matt, and again, you're going to get only the audio here, so I'll be referencing some things you can't see. Again, if you want everything, please just go register for the seminar series and just watch the ones that you like, because you're probably not going to want all of them. It's an incredible lineup. It's like 40 speakers and 5 panels. Awesome and free. But I'm going to go through, build, increase, hold, with each of the 3 primary things being kind of like a star player. Compost is the builder, cover is the increaser, and char is the holder. And I will come back at the end here and give you a little more information about the rest of the week and some other stuff. Well, hi, folks. Welcome to today's presentation on the 3 C's of soil health. For those that don't know me, I am Jack Spierko, a.k.a. the redneck hippie duck farmer. And my first slide for the presentation today is one I prefer not to actually do. I don't like to actually talk about myself or whatever. But when I do something like this, I do realize that, unlike when I'm talking to my podcast audience or something like that, some of the people that will watch this presentation will have no idea who I am. And I want to make sure you don't think I'm some guy that Googled, like, how to do a permaculture presentation about 15 minutes before I did this. So I am a well-known podcaster. That's the reason most people who do know who I am. I run a show called The Survival Podcast. We've won the Podcast of the Year award twice. We've been doing it 16 years, 3,600 plus episodes, and we cover everything involving what I would call resilient lifestyle design. So when it comes to permaculture, regen ag, growing your own food, the types of things I'm going to talk about today, to me, that is a key critical component to resilient lifestyle design. One, there's an economic component to being able to produce your own food. There's a preparedness component, but there's also a lifestyle health. If we're producing some portion of our own food, we know the quality of that food going into our body, and we are better able to adapt to all the stresses that come in life. I am well known as a permaculture teacher and speaker. I spoke at all three Permaculture Voices conferences back when those were going on. I think I might be the only person to have done that other than Diego, who, of course, put them together. I've taught a lot of different workshops on permaculture, many here at my own little place. We do that annually. We've probably done, in 11 years since I've been on this property, 25 on-site workshops that were multi-day experiences for students. I've worked in the field with people like Mark Shepard. I've spoken alongside people like Joel Salatin, Alan Savory, Elaine Ingham, Toby Hemingway, Paul Stamets, Jeff Lawton, Curtis Stone, a bunch of others. And to this day, like, I make this part of my life, but the primary systems that I work with that I've had to adapt to because of my property are ducks and other poultry. So ducks, chickens, geese. Many years I do a run of meat turkeys in the spring. I do a lot with aquatics and aquaponics. I am very carnivorous in my diet personally, so I focus a lot on meat and eggs and things like that. And I do annual gardens and perennials, though my perennial is limited to more like shrubs that are intensively cultivated, and then very hardy trees that are adapted to my landscape and climate type. So for those that don't know anything about my property, I sit on what was ancient ocean bed, which means it's limestone. It's a conglomerate limestone, and if you pull a hunk up with an excavator and you were looking at it from more than about 15 foot away, you would think it's like concrete rubble because it's a conglomerate of shells and limestone. It looks just like concrete. It's as hard as concrete. And the deepest spot on my ground where you dig down and hit that rock layer is about 11 inches, and the majority of the property is about 4. When you're trying to grow trees on that, there's a very limited thing that you can do. So we've moved toward very intensively managed systems, and that's what led me to the 3 C's that we're going to talk about today. But before we go into that, I want to tell you what my goals for this presentation are. I found that something that not enough teachers do is actually share their goals for their students with their students. And I always have 3 goals, and this is true when I'm doing a consultation, when I'm being a speaker. Back when I was in sales, if I'm doing a sales presentation, a marketing presentation, I always had the same 3. And that is, I want anybody listening to me to at least learn one thing, to laugh at least one time, and to come up with something that they're going to do because they spent the time to listen to me. And I feel that if I do not get that done, okay, that I failed you. I have failed my goal. I have failed you as an instructor. And I really have wasted our time. I've wasted my time, and I've wasted your time. And I come at this very much from a military mindset. I spent 3 years in the Army when I was a young man. In fact, I often say I became a man in the military, and I don't mean that, like, the military made me a man. Like, I joined the military when I was 17 years old. I got out just shy of being 21. I mean, literally, that little bottleneck history of my life. And that just is when a boy grows physically into a man. And I think if you're doing something at that point in your life, it sticks with you. And training is something that I try to take that military experience, and I've evolved it over about 30 years of my life as in the private sector. Teaching and training has always been part of what I've done. And in the military, you often think of things like, if you look at the picture on the top there, you got a recruit. It's probably like day one, maybe it's day four if you went through in processing now. You got 3 brown round drill sergeants screaming at him. He looks like he's about to cry. And this is what people think of when they think of military training. If you look at the bottom picture, it's more like a classroom situation. Kind of looks like something you might see like a small college or something. The only reason you know it's military is because everybody's wearing fatigues. There's a lot more training like that in the military than there is like the above picture where everybody's screaming at you. That's like your entry training, and even that entry training has a lot more classroom training than I think most people have never experienced it think. And kind of the key component to how we taught in the military is 2 things. A mindset of see one, do one, teach one. In other words, you see it, you demonstrate confidence in it, and you show somebody else how to do it. And if you do that long term, you become very masterful about a great number of things. But there's another piece to it, and that is to break it down to the things that the person needs to understand. And so that's what this presentation is going to be. It's kind of like drinking from a fire hose. I'm not going to go deep into any one of these three subjects. It's time crunch to get them into an hour individually, but I put them together because I want you to take from this the ability to learn, laugh, and come up with ideas to do. In that, there's also something you've probably heard different versions of. This is my version of it, and that is if you blank a thing, your odds of remembering it are, and then you fill in that blank. If you hear it, if all you do is hear it, let's say that your number is a one, and I like using a one for this base because I might have a better memory than you or you a better memory than me, but we all have our own baseline personally. So if all I do is hear it or read it, I'm at a one. If I write it down, and I mean the second that I hear it, recognize that it's new information that I don't know and I value it, if I write it down right then, I go straight from a 1 to a 10. It's a 10x on each level here. And I want to be very clear about this. If you hear it, and then later on you look it back up and you write it down, you probably don't get to a 10. You probably don't get to a 10. It's that snap experience of this is important, write it down. It reinforces the mind. If you then say it, if you say it, you speak it into being, you're 100. And if you actually take it and teach it to others, you're 1,000. My goal is to create as many teachers as I can. I do not believe in the secreting of knowledge. When I get to the end of this presentation, I will give you an email and a formula to use with the subject line. If you send it to me and there's anything you didn't get out of this presentation that you want to know, I will tell you. Okay? So I want to create teachers. But I also know, and I know this from experience, for every 100 students you have, you're lucky if you get one teacher. So you want to get at least the people to be able to hear it, write it down, and say it. And that saying it doesn't necessarily have to be verbal. What it has to be is doing something with it, come up with something to do. So you guessed it. As I'm going through this, if I say something, you're like, I didn't know that, and that's cool. I want you to hit pause, because it's a pre-recorded thing, and write it down. Just, you can write down 3 or 4 words that will remind you of it. It will have the same impact. And if you come up with an idea, something to do, then I want you to write that down as well. And see if you can get to the end of this and have a few things that you want to do because of this presentation. If so, we'll be moving along more like the bottom picture than the top picture there. So let's talk about soil fertility in 3 words here. This is another thing that I did in my time as a marketer. I would tell a company, if you can't break down what you do to your name of your company in 3 words, you don't know what you do. Because there is no company anywhere. I don't care who it is. I don't care how big it is. If you can't break it down to 3 words. And if you really, really, really push it, you can break it down to 1. But that usually requires a lot more explanation. And so whenever I do anything, I look for 3s. And 3s are incredibly powerful. They are about as many things as the mind can track simultaneously, an active thought process, number one. Number 2, they form what we call balance to word. Balance to word. And what that means is when you hear a list of 3, it's kind of like listening to music. Ba-boom, ba-boom, ba-boom. And it goes in the brain and it sticks. And then all the things that need to come off of it can naturally branch off of it, right? So my 3 for soil fertility are very simple. Build, increase, and hold. And all 3 of the things we're going to talk about today, compost, cover crop, and biochar, on some level help with all 3 of them. They are all multitaskers. But they're all awesome. Think about like a football team, right? Your quarterback probably can run. So your quarterback could alternate back in on some sort of trick play and be the running back. But your running back's probably a better runner. Your quarterback's probably a better thrower. And your receiver's probably a better receiver, a catcher, right? So we might roll that halfback out on the flat and toss a screen pass to him. But we're not probably sending him down the field 30 yards to try to break out against, you know, a defending player, you know, and beat that defending player and make that catch at that distance, you know, over his back. They each have this kind of starring role that they're the best at. Compost is the builder. Think of it as the foundation, and we'll go through these as we get into each one individually. Cover crop is the increaser. It's the one that stretches things. And biochar is the holder. It's the miser. It doesn't want to let go. And when we put them together, we build this three-man team that is just incredible at building and maintaining the best soil possible. I want you to think about this reality. The majority of people, when you get a piece of property and you decide you're going to start growing your own food on it, you do not have crap for fertility. In fact, crap would be better. Crap is fertility. We take crap and we turn it into compost. You've got garbage 90% of the time. Even if you've got some fertility, it is not really what you're looking for unless you're moving into a place that was organically gardened by a little old lady for the last 40 years. Great, if that happens. Most people start out with nothing. So you have nothing. So now we need a foundation. We need to pour a slab. That's your compost. We're building the initial fertility. We want to increase, and that's what our cover crops do. Our cover crops keep living root in the soil. They keep cover on the soil. They protect the soil. They form an armor. They create interactions with microbiology in the soil. And thereby, they don't just like a compost. Like I said, they all do everything. We add the compost. We increase fertility. Yay! But immediately that fertility goes into decline if there's not something for it to interact with. Your cover crop, whether it be, you know, for the sake of this piece, this very beginning, I want you to think of the cover in this today is when you look at your garden, you don't see soil. It could be you didn't have time to do a true cover crop this year, so you put down 4 inches of mulch through your winter. Okay? It could be it's middle of summer, you're growing everything, so you have tomatoes, peppers, eggplant, squash, and you're interplanted with flowers. Or it could be your season came to an end and you put down a mix of, you know, like let's say triticale, winter cereal rye, winter bell bean, and daikon radish, right? It could be a traditional cover. It could be anything. It all depends on the situation you're in. But what I'm saying is by having living root in the soil, by having active plants, you have carbon pumps that are actually taking carbon out of the atmosphere and putting into the soil. So that's our increase. And we have to have the increase, or we're going to fail. If we don't have the increase, we will fail. And here's what I mean by that. Let's say that you're building at a 10, but through each year, you're losing at an 11. You're a negative 1 every year. And that's why so many people that actually make really good compost, but they don't do other positive practices. And I'm not saying the way I'm teaching you today is the only way, just a way. But if all they're doing is compost, what they find is, well, every year I need just as much compost as the year before. That's because you're building and then falling instead of building and increasing. So that's why we want the cover crops in this. And then the hold. It's much easier to build and increase if we're not losing. Biochar is the miser. It is the guardian. When it grabs onto something, it takes an energetic process to get it to let go. So a plant and then this, you know, little biochar granule sitting down there in the soil, and there's some sort of microbes living in all the little compartments you'll see here in a minute, but there's also, let's say, manganese in there, and the plant needs manganese. The plant has to actively engage with some sort of biological process to extract the manganese. It's very extractable, but if without the plant, it's just going to sit there. It's adsorbed. It's not magnetism, but think of it like magnetism. Absorb is inside. Adsorb is attached. It's a almost a paramagnetic would be the right word, but it's not the correct word. Attachment. The cation exchange, the anion exchanges, these all come from that compost holding on to things and not wanting to let go of it, being very miserly. So let's start off with compost, which I call the builder, right? Compost is the builder, the foundation. I prefer bioreactor compost. And I use a modified method of Johnson Sioux composting. I'll have a picture of Dr. Johnson's work here in just a minute. This is a workshop being done at my property with my students. And you can see in the far right side, those are my students. They're wetting it down as we're adding the material. And we use 3-foot goat fence instead of 5.5-foot concrete reinforcing steel. It's just much easier to work with. You can adapt it to just about any size you want. We put pipes down in it. We stack it full of our material. We generally aim for about an 80-20 carbon nitrogen to 90-10 carbon nitrogen, somewhere in that, obviously with more carbon than nitrogen. We don't get too fussy about it, and we take good care of it. And I'm not going to get into exactly how to do bioreactor composting. I will tell you, since you're watching this, this is a part of the Our Soil presentation with Matt. If you are in where you can see the past episodes, because you have that kind of membership with him, I did a whole presentation 2 years ago on exactly how to do this type of composting. I want to stick more macro today at the higher level, but I want you to understand the basics of how it works. And if you go to my site, thesurvivalpodcast.com, and put in bioreactor, you'll find plenty of additional content on it. And I'll tell you where you can take a course with us if you want to do that as well when we get to the end. But I don't care exactly how you do this. I care about you taking care of your compost. I want you to understand one of the reasons it's very difficult to buy quality compost from somebody unless they're really in our world and they're either selling direct or they're selling with a very educated distribution channel, is that no one is going to look at compost the way that the person that made the compost is going to look at it. When you give birth to a child, like, everybody loves little babies and kids and stuff, but your baby is special to you. Your compost is special to you. You put the work in. You know what went in it. You know what's on the other side of it, and it matters to you. So you have to take care of it. Do you think Home Depot or Lowe's or Callaway's Nursery or even some of the more, local feed stores and all really understand that you're dealing with a life form? In fact, you're not even – a life form would be one thing. You're dealing with an ecosystem when you have compost. So you take this bag of compost, you throw it in the back of a tractor trailer, it's 1,000 degrees back there, it dries out, nobody's worried about it, they throw it on the shelf, it goes to this warehouse, that warehouse, it finally gets to sell to you. No, you can't treat your compost the way the store does. You have to take care of it. It has to stay moist, you don't want it to freeze all the way through. You want to take good care of it. You want to age it, and it really does get better with age, like a fine wine. The longer it has to mature before you break it apart and put it in your soil, whether it's an extract, a tea, whether you're spreading it, whether you're integrating it through potting soil that you're making yourself, whatever, the older it is, the more mature it will become. If you do high turn compost, that's fine. Minimum, by the time you're like, it's done, give it 60 days. Let me tell you something that I tell people to when it comes to getting information on how to compost, especially online, because everybody online is an expert because they said they were. When someone tells you that it's beautiful compost because they can look at it and tell, they don't know what they're talking about. Now, if you've made compost a long time, you kind of know, yeah, this is it, when I put this under a microscope, it's going to check out all right. And if I know everything that I did along the way, I will know that as well. But just because it looks like black dirt doesn't mean it's good compost. Because I could have compost that's absolutely been treated like crap or worse than crap, dried out. I could it'll look beautiful. It'll smell good. But it doesn't have, because this is all about the biology. We want to aim for lower pH. This is why I like bioreactor compost, because we end up naturally with a lower than otherwise pH. There's other methods of compost that are exceptions. Again, high turn, fine, as long as you age it at least 60 days. And I would say at least 60 days. Worm compost, black soldier fly, pretty much anything if you treat it like what it is, an ecosystem. I also want to throw this slide in here real quick. If you're from my audience and you're part of my membership program, there's a video from 2009 of exactly how to build this. But this is a bioreactor that I built before I heard the word bioreactor. I'm not sure exactly when Dr. Johnson first introduced bioreactor composting as a concept, but I think this may predate it. And all it is a Rubbermaid tub with some holes drilled in the top, the bottom, and the sides, a piece of perforated pipe in the center, and then a little pipe sticking out the side as a breather pipe to make sure you get full airflow up the center. It's simply a continuous composter. In other words, you keep adding compostables to it. You keep adding compostables to it, and you keep adding compostables to it until it gets full. And then you leave it alone until it's done breaking down. I made this in a system with three of them, and when one would fill up, I would start filling the other one. And when the third one would fill up, I considered the first one done. And I did little enhancements along the way. If I had a bunch of leaves to add to one, then I went out with my lawnmower and I threw some greens in with the leaves. If I had a lot of moisture that came in from the kitchen, like we had a big cookout or something, we had a bunch of leftover salad greens or something, they all went in as a lot of wet, Then we went out, pulled some leaves, and just that's all we did, and just layered it up. It makes some of the, to this day, still some of the best compost I've ever made. This works almost exactly like Johnson's, except it's really designed as a continuous composting method. The other thing I would say if you're doing this that you might really want to do is when you finish one off and that last bit of thermophilic hit is gone, you might want to add worms to it. But I never had to do that with these. You notice that there's holes in the bottom of the garbage cans all the way to the bottom so it had ground contact. Every one of these was lousy with worms and other things like macroarthropods and microarthropods and things like that when it finally got used because it was allowed to exchange with the air. But if you want to get into bioreactor compost, and I highly encourage you to do so, the whole point that we're trying to make with these longer duration composts, so this is the same with your high turn if you'll age it. We want it to be low disturbance. Now, obviously, when you're doing high turn, you don't have low disturbance while you're breaking down. But once you're aging it, leave it alone. Look at the picture there of the fungal hyphae on the right. That's the highways. That's the canals. That's the communications infrastructure of the soil. That's what mycorrhizal fungi are. And every time you turn it, you tear it asunder. So if you want it to be as healthy as possible, age it and be low disturbance. Make sure you stay in aerobic conditions. In other words, you want oxygen. I'm not putting down Bokashi and some of the other anaerobic methods if you're doing it on purpose. This type of composting, you want to keep it aerated. You want moisture and temperature control. You want carbon-rich materials. You want to take your time, either take a long time to compost or take a long time to age. When you take this approach, you end up with much lower than normal pH. You end up neutral to slightly acidic. Standard compost will be, just in general, following good practices, 7.5 to 8.5 on the pH scale. Bioreactor compost and well-aged compost will move more toward the 6 to 7.5. That is a huge variance. And then you want microbial diversity. This type of compost, I really encourage you to learn more about it, has over 500 species and subspecies through metagenomic testing of beneficial soil bacteria, including free-living nitrogen fixers. The most expensive input that farmers have is nitrogen. 78% of the air you breathe is nitrogen. Legumes are not the only thing that has a microbiological way to put nitrogen in the soil. There's over 20 well-known soil microorganisms that fix nitrogen without even interacting with plants, just doing their thing. What we need is that diversity, and there will be no nitrogen shortages in time. This all takes time. It's all like investing. And then I want you to really think about why we want to build the fungal hyphae, because that's going to tie into the other things we're going to get to here in a minute. This is, again, it's the infrastructure, it's the communications, it's the roads, it's the business bridges, it's the electrical lines. If you go look at a city, everything that takes material and goods and services and people in and out of that city, everything that allows somebody from one city to talk to somebody in another city, everything that does that is part of that infrastructure. And there is no more key infrastructure in the soil than the fungal hyphae. If you go to war with another country, and I don't mean these limited engagements that we do now, I mean like this country is trying to make this country surrender, the first thing you attack, the roads, the bridges, the communication lines, the infrastructure. If the army can't eat and it can't communicate and it can't resupply, it collapses every time. History has shown this. I mean, siege warfare back in the Middle Ages is basically the same thing. Surround the castle. You're not directly attacking the internal infrastructure. You're cutting off the external infrastructure. That's great if you're trying to, you know, win a war and collapse a country or take over a fortification. But if you're trying to build life in your soil, that's the last thing you want to do. So really think about that. Now, on your finished compost, what do you do with it? If you're making the kind of compost I teach, you can go straight on the garden. 1/4 inch to 2 inches is about what I will use, depending on how much I have and what I'm trying to do that year and how much area I'm covering. The reality, though, is good quality compost, about 400 pounds of the acre. 400 pounds of the acre will give you what you need from a microbiological boost. That means a heaping wheelbarrow load to a football field. So you don't need a lot. And that means that we as homesteaders and market gardeners and, you know, people that are not out doing measuring their acreage in hundreds or thousands of acres, this is easy. I also like to soak, strain, and apply. And what I mean by that is I am not big on making compost teas. And I learned this from Dr. Stephen Johnson. And I know a lot of people that are listening to me today love compost teas, and they're great. I understand why you do what you do. You're blowing up the microbial population, but you're also switching the balance. There are certain microorganisms in your compost that will really love 48 hours of being pumped full of oxygen and being given some sugar to feed on and being in a totally soaking wet environment. And there's others that are like, meh. And there's someone like, this thing's going to kill me, but I don't really like this. If we just do a simple extract, which is, here's what I do. I take a 5-gallon Pate strainer bag. You can buy a bunch of them on Amazon for a couple bucks, and one will last a season easy. You put that in the bag, throw 2 big handfuls of compost into the bucket, fill it up about 4 gallons, which is the bottom of the collar. You can see through it, and then stir it. I actually do use air stones for this because I don't want to sit there and stir it. 10 minutes. Pull the bag out, squeeze it out like you're making tea, because you are, and then just directly apply it. No dilution whatsoever. It is amazing what it does, and the best time to apply it is going to be in the evening just as the sun's going down. That way, that foliar feed sticks on those leaves, and it's there, you know, all the way until morning, and the stigmata open, and you get a lot better infiltration of it. Now, what do you do with the leftovers? Well, if you're going to be planting seed anytime soon, take some of those leftovers, that compost leaving, and make a slurry out of it and coat your seeds with it before you put them in the ground. It'll drastically improve your germination rates. The rest of it, you can, you know, that's left, you can do a lot of things with it. You can just put it around some of your plants that need a little bit more help. You can make little balls out of it, or you can directly make little balls out of it by soaking it and making it into like a little, like the ball you see in that center there. What I do with those, if I have a plant that's just looking a little sick, it's not quite doing as good as everybody else, I make one of those balls out of one of my compost piles. I dig a little hole next to it, and I put it right next to the roots and cover it up. It'll turn that plant around like instantly, nine times out of 10 at least. The other thing you can do with it is you can take it and put it in your worm bins, believe it or not. I know they're like, but the worms are already getting, no. What you're now doing is you're infusing more biology from outside back inside. Eventually, some of that worm compost is probably going to go back into a larger compost pile. I know a lot of you guys that listen to Matt are being into the indigenous microorganism. Everything I'm teaching you today is like the lazy man's IMO, indigenous microorganisms. Matt says it's patience. When he looked at my operation, he said, you know what you are? You're patient. I said, I don't know if I'm patient or lazy, but I'm not in a hurry. Either way, I'm not in a hurry. And by giving nature time to work, nature's really willing to work with you. So the root inoculant balls are something I do. I do make potting soil. I'll save my comments on that for later when we get into biochar. You can also sell it. I don't sell any of my compost. I've given away compost. I've given people like a 1-gallon bag of my compost. And they're like, oh, okay, well, thanks. You can tell they're not really enamored. But once you explain how to use it with an extract, and then they try it, they're like, oh, tell me how to make it. And that's what I'm really looking for, is to teach people. So let's move into cover crops, right? Now, cover crops are an increaser, right? So we're going to build the compost, and we're going to continuously build, which is our increase, throughout our year-round. I want you to think about compost applications. Most gardeners, they make compost probably in the fall and early winter, and then in the spring, they throw the compost on the garden. Maybe they do it one more time in the fall, and that's it, right? Hell, most gardeners, they go to Home Depot or Lowe's, and they buy a bag of junk, and they think they did that. They didn't even actually make real compost. But even if you do it right, if you do everything we just talked about, you put it on there, and what happens? Entropy comes, and it starts to off gas. It starts to be consumed. It starts to be used. We need an active process that's actively growing the fertility while the fertility is being used. Otherwise, we are what? We are unsustainable. We damn sure are not regenerative. So what is a cover crop? A cover crop is any, in the strict definition, any plants that we purposefully and intentionally plant at a specific time in our gardens or on our farms to increase, enhance soil fertility and to protect the soil until our next, you know, quote unquote, profitable or money crop or production crop, right? So the classic gardener finishes up the year. They've got all the tomatoes and eggplant and peppers they can use for the season, and it's going to go into winter. Maybe they're going to go fishing or hunting or something, or just enjoy the family and just kind of take some time off, right? The seasonality is nice. And so they leave their garden alone, and they end up in the spring with a huge digging project. The garden gets planted too late. The fertility quality's gone downhill. There's weeds everywhere. It sucks. Cover crop, come in. We do something like a couple grasses, a legume, and maybe a brassica, like a daikon radish or something, or a mustard, or who knows what. And we make that mix, and we plant that, and then we terminate that when we're ready to do the next planting. And there's a bunch of ways to do that that I won't get into today, but crimping and flaming and tarping are kind of the easy go-to buttons and combinations thereof for the home gardener. And it's just basically anything that covers the soil. For today, I want you to think a little bit differently. If the soil has active root growing in it, if there's not a lot of space for things to grow that we don't want to grow, I'm going to say we have cover. Is it an intentional cover crop? No, but your tomatoes and peppers and things like that, and we interplant flowers, or we even interplant some things that we think of as cover crops. Like, I like to do things like I'll go in little areas and spaces. I'll go put little pinches of something like the Japanese millet in the summer. Grows really fast. It produces a seed head. Cut those off, throw them to the ducks or what have you, and it grows right back. And that's occupying a space a weed won't go, and it's a different plant than I'm growing for my consumption. So it's asking for different things, and it's giving different things, and that diversity is building up fertility for us, okay? So it's all cover unless we're specifically doing it only for cover, right? And then it's still cover. That's the way I want you to think today, is you think more holistically when I kind of bring this together at the end into how we actually do this on our farm. How long have humans been doing this? Well, Washington and Jefferson, our founders, wrote letters to each other complaining that the colonists weren't doing enough. Records in China, India go back to 1,000 years, thousands of years ago, right? We have written tablets that were found in Mesopotamia that are thousands of years old. Before Chem Ag, you either covered or you moved. We didn't have tractors. If we go back prior to like the modern version of the plow, even if it was driven by an oxen, it was a very labor-intensive process. So once you had something working, you really didn't want to give it up. You either went into a slash and burn, a slash and char, or you did a cover crop. Those were your only real choices. We use cultivated species for covers versus like, well, why don't we just let it go fallow? Because we don't control things when we do that. We end up with a lot of plants that are maybe perennial and will come back from tiny pieces of root, like certain docks and things like that. So by using intentional cover, we get more control and we have a better ability to terminate. Terminate is exactly what it sounds like. I don't want this thing anymore. I want it to go away. And in my course on this, I teach, again, like 8 different methods of cover crop termination, but the primary ones we use are crimping, and that can be done with a 4-foot garden with a 4-foot 2x4 with a piece of angle iron bolted on the bottom and a piece of rope to hold it, and you step it down about every 6 inches. Make 2 passes, and you do a good job of crimping. If you hit it with a flaming torch before you do that while it's standing up, and then you're not trying to burn it down when you do that. You're just basically roasting it, like throwing couple handfuls of greens like spinach and arugula in a pan. You make it bright green, then you eat it. Well, you've ruptured the cells, so it's not going to grow back well. So those two together are kind of my go-to. And that's the termination. Planting green, something else I wanted to cover with you today. If you hear that as you start doing more research, I hope that I make you hungry to learn more about these things. And you go out and learn. And if you start listening to like podcasts on these, you hear farmers that are talking to other farmers that know what they're talking about. They use words that you don't understand, right? Planting green is what it sounds like, though. It means that before you terminate the cover crop, you plant the next production crop, and you terminate on top of that. You want to be if you're doing that, you want to go to a straight something like a straight crimping. You don't really want to flame when you've just laid down seed. That would be a bad idea. You could, though, Flame, lay down seat, and then crimp, and that's a good way to go as well. And where does it work, though? This is like when I released my course on cover crop, but I live here. I'm like, do plants grow where you live? Because you probably wouldn't be asking me if you lived in the, you know, the North Pole and there's no soil, it's all ice. You probably wouldn't be asking. If there's dirt and plants grow in dirt, then cover cropping works. It's just finding the right cover crops for the right time of year in the right process. And that comes down to matching your benefit with your context and your goals. And so the first thing we need to understand is, well, what are the benefits of cover crop? What do I get out of this if I cover crop? You get increased soil organic matter. Soil organic matter should be minimum 2% and should be closer to 5%. And if it's higher, that's even better. But if you're going to farm land, you want 2% minimum. The average farm in America today is under a half. So if you want to increase organic matter, and you do, then you want to always have something living in the soil. Again, these plants are carbon pumps, right? We all learned about photosynthesis in school, right? In grade school, you learned about this. Eighth grade science, right? I had to write a report on this, if I remember right, in sixth grade on photosynthesis. So we know this, but we forget it because they don't teach us why it matters. We just learn these random facts they throw at us in school that you have to memorize. I got an A on the test. I'm not going to worry about this shit anymore. This turns out to actually be one of those things we should really be teaching people that actually is important. Like, all life on the planet depends on this. And the soil organic matter component in photosynthesis, they don't teach you that at all, do they? C6H12O6, blah, 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 blah. Boom. And the kid writes it down and then forgets it. But in that process, a whole host of chemistry and biology is opened up like a giant can of soil whoop-ass down in that soil. And so we want that going on. We get, because of that pumping, we get increased biological activity. If you have carbon in the soil, you have more life in your soil. That's part of why all carbon, all life is carbon-based that we know of anyway. We haven't found anything like silicon-based life on Star Trek yet. We want infiltration, percolation, and retention of water. Infiltration, it rains, the water goes in. You know, but, and that's something I think is pretty well understood in our space at this point. Like, if you get a rain and it's not some heroic rain where it's just a flood, when you look at the ground, you don't want to see a puddle. Puddle means the water didn't go in. The puddle can mean that you got an inch of rain and 2 inches down, the soil's dry. That's what that can mean. You've got compaction. So you want water to go in, but you also want percolation. You want water to be able to come up. You want, if the water level is down lower and the plant's roots aren't quite to where the soil is really wet, for it to be able to actually draw water up through the soil. That makes you more resistant to drought. And you want to retain the water. Just like I say, build, right? Increase hold. If you get rain, you want to hold on to it without it being too wet, without it being anaerobic, without it being muck. You want to hold it as long as you can. You want a battery in your soil. Cover crops really enhance the ability to build that battery. We want to prevent erosion, attract pollinators and predators, eliminate and reduce inputs. These things are expensive and they take time. The less you have to do, the more you'll do the things that you have to do. Think about that again. Another way to put that, what would you do if you didn't have to do it? If somebody would do it for you, would you do all the things? If you could like push a button and summon somebody like some rich guy on a TV comedy show, you know, Jenkins, please go out and water the garden for me. You would always have your garden watered, right? You would just say, and give back, you would just have a thing that reminds Jenkins to do it for you. But the less, since we're not going to live in that world, the less you have to do, the more you'll get done of what you have to do, because there's less work involved. If you have a system that's highly resilient and requires less irrigation and can more rely on natural rainfall, not only is it more self-sufficient, not only is it more self-reliant, regenerative, etc., but it's going to produce more for you with less input of work. You want to weed suppress. If you do not, go out and look in nature. If you see bare ground, something bad happened. Dog pissed there too many times and killed the plants. Somebody compacted it. There was a fire. It's a disturbance of some kind. Soon thereafter, unless the disturbance continues, something will fill it in. If you have a bare spot in your yard and it won't come back in, the dog has done it, the kid's done it, something's happened, you need to go out there and decompact. You need to do something, and nature will take back over. But your garden is hopefully not compacted like that. So if you don't put something in a spot, nature will find a way to put something in there. So by interplanting and covering, we suppress weeds, we increase our biodiversity. Diversity is the strength with the right diversity, okay? It's not just a catchphrase for DEI and things like that. Diversity in an ecosystem is everything. Because each thing, each component has different things it takes and different things that it gives. And when we add one to something that already has 100, we get about a 10,000 increase in possible combinations. That's just how the math works out. It helps to regulate temperature. This isn't hard to understand. Go stand in the shade, go stand in the sun. And then phytoremediation. In other words, we actually can use cover crops to reduce residual toxins in our soil. So how do we figure out what to plant? Well, again, I don't have time to go into exactly what to plant. I'm going to give you a slide here. You can screenshot it. You can replay the video. You can make copies of it. You can do whatever you want with it. Of all the plants that I particularly have worked with over the years and come to put in my list of, like, I'm not saying use all of them, but here's your building blocks. And from those building blocks, I would tell you, you want at least one grass, right? You want at least one brassia. You want at least one nitrogen fixture. And you want at least two of those. One of those, right? So you have two grasses, one brassia, one nitrogen fixer. You could have one grass, two brassias, and one nitrogen fixer. You could have more than that, but that's your minimum. That's what I'm telling you to start with. Or you need to include flowers, especially in spring and summer when most of us are not going to be cover cropping in the conventional sense. You're going to have space. If you space your peppers 18 inches apart, can a weed grow in that space between your two pepper plants? The answer is yes. I know I'll plant my pepper plants 6 inches apart and you'll get less peppers. You'll get more pepper plants in the garden, but you'll get less peppers because the peppers need that edge for airflow, for light, et cetera, to function. They can't grow well compacted into each other. You're going to get lots of peppers on, you know, your edges then, and then very few in between. But if we were to plant something like phyllox or something like that in between there, or sweet alyssum or what have you, now we're going to suppress those weeds. We're going to get the biological interaction, and the pepper that's taller is going to function. So one way or another, we need to be thinking like that. You want several different root types. If you look at the image, there's all different types of roots. You want deep roots. You want shallow roots. You want tap roots. You want hairnet looking roots. You want very fibrous roots, etc. The more diversity you have in that, the more soil profile you cover, the better you will build and increase your fertility. When in doubt, select more, add another one. If you're not sure, add an additional crop that's right for the time and your other goals. And if you have concerns, you're not really sure, test a small area. Make a mix, test a small area, see how it does for you. And that way, if it's something that's hard to terminate or something like that, it's easier to deal with. Here's my list. I'm not going to read it all off or anything like that. Again, you can just screenshot this for yourself, make copies of it, do what you want. Again, at the end, I'm going to give you an email address and a formula for the subject line. Ask me questions that I can't answer in a pre-recorded presentation. And if you want the deck, I will send you my entire deck. Again, I don't believe in the secreting of knowledge, but it's broken down into winter cover crops, summer cover crops, and my 16 interplanting flowers that I call my Sweet 16. Just because it sounded cool, and I like to do things that people can remember. But I'll real quick go through a couple of the flowers that I really love in this mix. One is Phacelia. This is actually taken off as a major cover crop being used in conventional ag, especially like in California and places out that way because it does so well there. It blooms really early. The attraction to bees is insane. It's absolutely alyssum. I love Sweet alyssum, grows low, it's prostrate, it's a ground cover, billions of little flowers. I'll tell you one thing about it. I do not restrict my chickens from my garden, and I've never had to, until I started growing alyssum. They eat it like candy. I couldn't figure out why it was disappearing. It turns out alyssum is basically a brassia. I didn't know that, and chickens love it. Sunflower, I really like to grow different sunflowers, but just plain old black oil sunflower birdseed is a fantastic cover crop, brings in a lot of your pollinators. Phyllox and Cosmos. I love Marigold. It's on the list, but Phyllox and Cosmos end up being, I believe, actually a better a better choice for most people. Marigolds are not the repellent that people think they are. The primary thing they'll do for you is they'll actually trap and kill nematodes, the kind you don't want, like root knot nematodes. And I don't think it got on the list here, and I'm not sure how, but I've actually, maybe it's because I have it somewhere else, like under summer, but safflower. Safflower has become one of my go-tos as well. Maybe I wasn't using it yet when I first made this list, because I don't see it on the list, but safflower has a tremendous benefit from a pollination standpoint. It has a tremendous benefit from the root type that it puts down. But it also is a harvestable resource in that when you let the safflower go to bright orange and you pull the petals off of the plant, it's a replacement for saffron, hence safflower. And I actually think it has just as good a color and much better of a flavor contribution. I don't really get why saffron is so expensive other than it's hard to produce in quantity because it looks beautiful, but it doesn't really, to me, have any flavor characteristics. If you like using saffron in your cooking, you'll love using safflower to make your own version thereof. A little bit more on cover crops and just the whole thing we're talking about today before we move on to biochar. I think one of the biggest places people get hung up is the difference between techniques, tactics, and strategy. And I would just like you to think about that for the holistic nature of what I'm trying to cover for you today. So a technique is like broadcasting or drilling seed. A tactic is, well, you plant immediately after harvest to protect the ground, maybe a cover crop, okay? A strategy is annually using diverse covers to increase soil health, water retention, biodiversity, to combine for long-term garden sustainability and productivity. That's actually my strategy, or one of my strategies here on Nine Mile Farm. It sounds a little bit like, without the bullshit mixed into it, like a venture capitalist proposal. And it should sound a little bit like that of a strategy. The problem is people always start at the technique. They do a poor implementation of the tactic, and they have no idea what their strategy is. So what I mean by that is people go out and watch a video, and they see people put in a food forest, and they see they put in a swale. So people go and put a swale in, and they plant a bunch of trees in it. They really don't know why they put the swale where they put it. They don't know what trees they put in there. They don't know what seven layers they've incorporated in as far as your ground covers, your shrubs, or why. They just emulated the technique, and they probably put it in a bad place. That's a tactical error, and they have no overriding idea of what they're trying to achieve. So as you're looking at all of this, including what you plant, that's how to think. Start off with what you're trying to achieve, and then use the techniques and tactically implement them so that you can achieve the strategy. Just change the way you think. Real quick before we move on from here, I want to hit you with the spheres of the soil. I know I'm going to go tight on time today. It is what it is. Matt is pre-recorded, right? But I could leave this one out. This is something, again, I talk about how we all learn photosynthesis in school. We should learn this in grade school. That when you look at soil, there's spheres, which in other words, like you have the north and south hemisphere of the earth. There's spheres of the soil. There's the detritosphere. That's all the stuff on the top. That's your natural mulching, right? That's your detritus. Right? That's that top layer. Then you've got your drillosphere. Your drillosphere, like a drill. Well, that's where your worms and your other critters go up and down in the soil, and they leave burrows behind. That helps with infiltration. You have a rhizosphere. That's your roots, where the roots are in the soil. Then you have your agratosphere. The agratosphere is where your aggregates are held as aggregates. So instead of having this uniform soil profile that just looks like dirt, because that's all it is, you actually have different sizes and different pieces. It looks like kind of like cottage cheese, little marbles, little pebbles of soil. But if you took those little pebbles and squished them, you could break them up into dust. They're held together with biogels. And this also allows for infiltration. And if you have enough organic matter, which you wouldn't have the agratosphere without the organic matter, also for the percolation to move water up and down in the soil profile. And then you have the porosphere. With the porosphere is the empty space. And you'll see later how important that really is. Moving on to biochar. Biochar is charcoal. And all biochar is charcoal, but not all charcoal is biochar. Biochar is charcoal that has been pyrolyzed, which is to separate with heat, is what pyrolysis means, to separate with heat, been pyrolyzed long enough in the absence of oxygen, that's to separate with heat in the absence of oxygen, that it's burned off all the volatiles and all we have left is the carbon skeleton of the biomatter that we pyrolyzed. Okay? In other words, we burn it, but not to ash. We burn it down to its skeleton, and then one way or another, we stop that, whether we completely cut off all oxygen or we use water, one way or another, we stop it. And we end up with this incredibly beautiful, porous material. And the best way to think of it is coral to the sea. Think of, in fact, it's a great analogy. I think I came up with it. I know I said it before I heard anybody else say it. I'm not sure. Maybe somebody said it before me. But if you look at what biochar looks like under a microscope, and you think about what coral looks like, and I don't mean all the pretty coral. I mean like the rock coral underneath that it's all attached to, that's the last life form that died, left its skeleton, and the new life form is growing on it, and that reef keeps getting bigger and bigger if we don't damage it. It looks a lot like that, doesn't it? Little places for things to anchor, little places for things to live. That's what biochar is. And when we do this, we're really going to gain some things in our soil. One, we gain all these little apartments for all of these little soil organisms to live in. We're also going to retain, remember we talked about moisture? Biochar will hold about 7.5 times its weight in water. So a pound of biochar will hold 7.5 pounds of water. That's almost a gallon. It's just under a gallon. So a way to think of it is about per 8 to 8.5 pounds. I'm sorry, for about every 1.2 pounds of biochar that you add to your soil, you increase your water holding capacity by a gallon. You know, kind of think in your head, if you look at a 4-foot by 8-foot bed, and if you put 1 gallon of 1 gallon jug full of water in every square foot of that 4-foot by 8-foot bed, 32 gallons of water, if you put an equivalent amount of biochar in there, that's the whole, that's not how much water you add. You can always add water if you really want to. That's how much holding capacity that you have added. Think about being able to hold an extra gallon of water per square surface foot or cubic foot of your garden space. Really easy to do with an appropriate amount of biochar. It also has many uses beyond the soil, and I want to hit a few of those for you. One, it will reduce smell and off-gassing of livestock bedding. It will improve the feed efficiency of your livestock by adding it to your feed, and it's just small amounts, really. You could increase your feed efficiency by about 20%, meaning you're going to buy 20% less feed. It used to be in livestock feed. The feed manufacturers went to the government and said, regulate it out. We don't like putting it in there because it's a relatively expensive ingredient and it has no nutritional value. What they left out was, and we sell less feed because of it. So that's why it was taken out. It'll bind up human waste in off-grid situations. It is good for insulation and alternative building technology, though understand that it also blocks EMF and EMI waves. So a small amount of it in the construction of a building may actually block things like cell phone signals, and you may actually need some sort of a repeater if you're to build an entire structure out of it. It's basically a way to turn your house into a Faraday cage. It's good for toxic soil remediation. Billy Bond and Alan Booker are using it extensively for that with their teams right now in North Carolina. I'm actually working on a project right now with the Price Pottinger Foundation, which is Dr. Weston A. Price, to find some land and actually do some remediation using biochar. It's good for aquatic systems filtration. It's good for food storage. If you take something like potatoes or apples or something you're going to store in your pantry long term, you put a tray down, put a couple inches of biochar on the bottom and stack it on top of it, your food will last longer. The off-gassing, like ethylene and other volatiles that off-gas that actually accelerate decomposition, the charcoal absorbs it and holds on to it. Well, now that nutrient can eventually end up in your garden, but in the meantime, you've extended your food storage life. It presents pesticide runoff and groundwater by grabbing onto it and making it essentially inert. It lightens potting soil instead of perlite or peat. And, of course, we can use it as a soil amendment. But I wanted to hit this. This is where you see a picture in the slideshow, and you're like, what the hell does this have to do with gardening and permaculture and all this stuff? This is Jack with a bunch of fish. There's a black tip shark. Next picture over is the Goliath grouper. That's a baby. He's about 80 pounds. A fairly nice barracuda and a red grouper. What does that have to do with biochar being the coral reef of the sea? The thin picture across the top there is in one of my favorite places in the world. It's called Sanibel Island near Fort Myers, Florida. And this, the island itself has this causeway, a bridge that goes out to it. This is, was very hard to actually find one of these pictures. This is a picture when they put the new bridge in, but the old bridge was still there. And there's a car going over it right in the center. And if you look at the lower bridge, it's to the front side of it, you can kind of tell that's a drawbridge. When they first put this in, this whole area was nowhere near as developed as it is now. It didn't have the tourism it did now. I was a kid back then. I grew up in Jacksonville, Florida, and we would go down there. And when you met people on the beach, everybody was from Florida. You know, you didn't meet people that maybe you met somebody from Georgia. That was about it. Now you meet people from all over the world in this place. So when they built it to save money, they built a drawbridge and they lowered the height of the bridge. And so bigger ships that came through had to wait for the bridge to open. So eventually they said, we need to put in a higher bridge. When they were done putting the new bridge in, they tore the old bridge down. They got rid of it. Otherwise, it would still be in the way. They had a huge amount of rubble. This thing's a couple miles long to get out to the island. They took it out to sea about 7 miles out in rubble on barges, and they just threw it in. In the first couple of years, you know, maybe some people threw some crab pots out there or something, but in general, it wasn't much. Now, when I go fishing there and I hook up with my guide, as long as the weather's right and we can go 7 miles offshore, we go straight to that. And all these fish were caught over that reef that started out as the concrete rubble from a bridge. The reason I put that there, this took time. This took time to end up the way that it is today, where it can produce this. And think about the incredible diversity that must be down there for this many game fish to be there. You know, black tip shark, Goliath grouper, barracuda, red grouper. Red grouper, the one on the right, they're beautiful fish. I had one of those on the same trip, about twice the size of the one in that picture. Really beautiful fish. Was excited. Was going to eat some grouper. Grouper sticks or something. They had some fried grouper that night because they're delicious fish. Got that fish to about 15 foot in the water, super clear, can see beautifully what it is, and it's coming. Oh, it's going to be great. And a giant black looked like the top of a garbage can closing on it, and it just vanished and just peeled the line off the reel. And as soon as I actually tried to put any pressure on it, it broke off. My guide estimated it's one of those Goliaths like you see in the second one from the right there or the left. He said it's probably a 400 or 500 pound fish. It just ate this grouper that was probably like a 20 pound grouper, like it was a bait fish. That's what adding a reef does to the ocean. What we need to understand is if you look at the pictures there, there's no land, there's no marks, there's no nothing. If you were out on the ocean over this reef, you would see nothing. And if you didn't know it was there, if you didn't have some sort of technology like fish finding technology, sonar, right? If you couldn't look down and see that there was some structure there, it looks the same as everywhere else. That's your soil. That's why biochar is such a good analogy to being a coral reef. You look at your soil, you don't see it. You got to put it in a microscope to understand what's going on. So what we really want to do then, since it's such this long-term investment, again, when they tore that bridge down and they dumped all that stuff out there in the ocean, it didn't do much right away. It took time to work. And biochar is a longer project than that when we put it in our soil. It's forever. Now, it's not forever because eventually, you know, if we want to go to the extreme, one day the sun will swallow the earth and burn it up. So it's not forever. For your lifetime, for your human lifetime, for seven generational thinking, it's forever. It will be here in that soil unless somebody takes it away physically, and it will still be doing its job when your great, 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 great grandchild wants to plant into it, if they're fortunate enough to be using the same land you left behind. That's how long it is. So with that in mind, we're in no hurry to get it there. We have time to let it come through the system and become an ally in the fight against entropy. So livestock bedding and feed is one place we talked about already. Extending the life of storage like food, like fruits. But we can also add it to things like our worm farms, our black soldier fly bins. We use it in aquaponics and aquaculture systems. I've heard people, oh, you don't want to use it in aquaponics. You want the plants to get the nutrients in aquaponics. The thing is, you can put one ebb and flow bed in there, fill it with biochar,
ebb and flow it for a couple weeks. It's fully charged up. It's not going to take much more out. It'll help keep the water clean, but it's not going to take much more nutrient out. So now that biochar can come out and it can go somewhere else in your system. If you're doing aquaculture, what a great filtration medium that then can be repurposed into your compost, okay? One way or another, kick it high up in the system, high up in the system. Human waste management. Now, not everybody's going to do human manure. I understand. I don't really want to. I get it. But if you use biochar and you're doing the 5-gallon crap in a bucket thing, and every time you go, you add some carbon and some biochar, there won't be any stink. When people say there won't be any stink with, you know, just some carbon, yeah, I'm sorry, wrong answer. I don't believe you. I've been there, done that. Biochar really will, if you use enough, hold it up. But also urine. And you always want to separate solid waste and liquid waste from human beings. This is what made Terra Preta. We know because of the biochemistry in Terra Preta, the famous soils of Amazonia, without the human waste component, because they didn't have livestock. They didn't have livestock. And they had to deal with their human waste. They didn't have a sewer treatment plant either. If you want to recreate Terra Preta, some sort of, you know, physical waste product, some sort of solid and liquid waste product actually has to be part of it, along with some other things that we won't get into today. But even if all you did was make a pee bucket outside around back of the shop, gentlemen, and all you did was add biochar to it so it wasn't ever sopping wet, and when you let that kind of dry out, that biochar is fully charged up, and it is 15-part nitrogen fertilizer, and you can use it the exact same way, and it will give you all of the benefits of biochar in your compost or your soil thereafter. So you can make all the high nitrogen fertilizer you want just from your own pee and biochar, and you don't need anything else. You don't even need a compost to do that. A component in your potting mix. It will lighten your potting mix. It's incredible. Take some of your compost. Take some good granulated, very finely ground up biochar and mix 10 to 15% in your compost and put it in a pile of just your compost and one with the biochar. You won't believe the difference. It almost creates an aggregation in of itself. It looks totally different. Every person I've handed it to that's looked at it has been blown away by it. And it's very simple what's going on. By evenly distributing the charcoal, and the charcoal holds 7.5 times its weight in water, it evenly distributes the moisture, and it creates this beautiful crumb structure. Once you see that, I promise you, you're going to want to use it in your garden. And then in all composting, oh, by the way, when I make potting soil, I always use perlite. Why? Do I need it? Not really. I use it like one big scoop. I use like the 55-gallon Rubbermaid tubs, the black and yellow tubs, as like that's how much potting soil I need pretty much every year to do all my starts. And I use like one big like feed scoop of perlite in there. You know, one big bag will last you 20 years. Because it's white, you can see it, and you know you've mixed it enough that you fully distributed everything, including the biochar. But in all composting, Bokashi, High Turn, Bio-Ray, I don't care. The key is to integrate it so that it really isn't an extra step other than you have to make it. As far as making it, lots of ways, T-LUDs, Tin Man retorts, etc. But an open burn kiln is about the easiest thing to do. There's three methods here. One is known as the best biochar kiln. I'm not saying I own one. I like it. It's really good. I'm not saying it's the best. That's what they call it if you want to look it up. It's a cone kiln, very simple, but it's fairly thin steel. You rivet it together, and they built it that way so they could ship it flat. It's still kind of expensive for shipping. It costs you about $200 shipped to your house. On the far right, you have a 55-gallon drum, metal drum, $15-$20. You can buy them just about anywhere, Craigslist, Facebook Marketplace, find them all over the country. That one is done with what I call a saddle cut, where you take like an angle grinder or a plasma cutter and cut a saddle across it horizontally. That's nice because you can fit big material in it. Most of the time you spend getting material ready for making it a charcoal will be sizing it. So less sizing, less work. But you see the center? That's my Weber kettle grill. That's become like my go-to, especially with small material. It's easy. It takes about 2 hours to completely fill it with a continuous add method, and you're done. And it's very thick, and it's made for high-intensity heat. It was built to do that. They're about $250 brand new, and then you have a grill. But if you go to Facebook Marketplace, I bet you can find one in good condition for $50 or less near your home, unless you live in the middle of nowhere. So that's my little add-on for you there. About to wrap up here. I want to explain the holistic nature of this. And yes, Matt, I'm going to take more time. Sorry, bro. But ideal soil composition. Would it be good to know that? Unless you saw my presentation from a couple years ago where this was in it, has anybody told you what ideal soil composition is? Like, you need this many nematodes. I'm not talking about, you know, how many nematodes should be there per nanoliter or something like that. No, I mean just the physical structure of the soil. It should have, now, this is going to vary from evaporation and saturation, but about 25% of perfect soil in its nirvana state should be moisture. About 25% of it should be air. Remember we had that slide? Let's go back to it real quick. The spheres of the soil, that porosphere, that's the spaces in between the aggregates. That should be about 25% of the entire, like a scoop of soil, should be empty space. About 45% inorganic. That's your base minerals of your soil, your base soil type, sand, et cetera, right? And then about 5%, and more is fine, especially if we take it away from the inorganic, right? And so we go to 10% and that drops our inorganic to 40, that's fine. But this is like the minimum to be like nirvana soil. 5% organic matter, 40%, 5% inorganic, 25% air, 25% water. Think about that structure, that porosity in biochar, and how well that helps with that. Every little granule of that thing is as much space as it is mass. Okay? It's empty space and mass are about equal. So right there is going to create that tilth that everybody wants in their soil. All right, so real quick, I want to say a few things here about how we do this on our farm, and then I'll bring that last slide up again for you. So I want you to think about everything we covered today. And again, I think it was probably like drinking from a fire hose, just and I didn't get into the exact how-to in a lot of this stuff because I just can't cover it in the time that I'm given to cover something this holistic. But now that you have the overview, This is life at Nine Mile Farm. We get up in the morning, we make coffee. The coffee goes through a strainer. The strainer goes into a Tupperware thing on top of the counter. Next to the Tupperware thing on top of the counter is a quart jar. Guess what's in it? Biochar is in it. At any time, that Tupperware container with a lid on it, so the flies don't invade it in the kitchen, especially in the summertime, starts to look a little wet, a little nasty, a little gooey, but it's not ready to go out to the birds yet. We just throw a tablespoon or two of biochar on top with the lid back on it. All our cuttings, scraps, et cetera, go in there. When that thing's full or it's just like it's time for it to go, it goes out to the worm bin. Some of it gets added to the worm bin. The rest of it goes out to a pit. The pit is right next to the duck coop. The pit is just a square made out of cinder blocks. The ducks and chickens and geese come out in the morning. First thing they do is hit the pit. They incorporate it. They see what they can get out of it. They eat the food, they eat the biochar, goes into their digestive system, it enhances what they're doing. We haven't done anything yet that you probably aren't already doing. You could be doing something different. We just incorporated the biochar into the compost collection process. The pit is not even a finished product. It is just a storage area that eventually ends up in the bioreactor, okay? The birds get fed right next to the stack of bird feed is also a jar of biochar. About every third or fourth day, some biochar goes in the feed. That reinforces that. Yeah? Okay, the birds get fed. They have to get fed anyway. Now it's in their system. They're distributing through the whole property. And at night, they go home to the coop. Birds go in the coop. Coop has straw down. Straw is the primary compost carbon that we make in our biocompost once a year. Every time we add a bale or two of straw, we add a five-gallon bucket of biochar to the coop. Okay, it just happens. There's no real extra work in that because the biochar making process is the only extra work. It's just spread the bucket out and add the straw. Wear a dust mask when you do this or dampen your biochar. Biochar is safe to eat. It's not safe to breathe. You'll give yourself the coal miner disease back black lung. So the straw goes down with the biochar. Yeah, no problem. Okay, now once a year, I usually run a workshop for this. I have students come in to help me and learn, and we build two or three bioreactors. Now there's biochar in the charcoal or the compost, isn't there? That pit, what we do is we dig that out into a wheelbarrow, and as we're building the bioreactors, every layer we sift some of that older all that biology, all of that year long of the birds, all of that stuff that came in, little bits of biochar here and there. Okay. Another thing we do, we bring out a bucket of worm castings and we sprinkle a little bit of that in there, just a little bit for the fungal hit that's in there. And then we start running our bioreactor. The bioreactor starts to run. The temperature comes up, hits 140, 150 degrees, and it begins to ebb off. As it ebbs off, we keep it, we run, you know, the process of taking care of the bioreactor is keep it wet, don't let it freeze. That's pretty much it. And keep it capped. We cap ours with wood chips instead of landscape fabric like Dr. Johnson does. So wood chips are given a fungal hit. Okay? Okay, we have a thermometer. We stick that in there. It goes down below 90 degrees in the center. Now we go to the worm farm. We take a great big handful of worm castings with worms. We come out, we pull the wood chips back, and we seed the whole thing with worms and castings and biochar and biology and everything else. We push the wood chips back over, and then it's just automatically watered for a year. That's it. The compost is done. We don't have to turn it. We don't have to touch it. We're ready to go. When it's time to plant, we take some of the compost, and if we're doing a seeding where we're doing a broadcast like a cover crop, we cover it with a half inch to an inch of compost. It's done. It's all integrated. It's all happened. It's already there. Yeah? Okay? When it's springtime, we go out to one of the finished compost piles. I take enough compost to make my potting soil for the year, and I add more biochar to it even though it's already there. To lighten it even further, I add the perlite. I add my other amendments like rock dust and things like that. Now I start my seeds and my seed starting system. So you're probably doing that anyway. All we've done is we just tied it all together in a holistic cycle instead of it all being disconnected. Now that plant, I use solo cups, 6-inch deep red solo cups like we all used to drink beer out of for $2 a head at keg parties, if you're old enough to remember when you could do it that cheap, okay? It's plastic, I know, and I don't want to drill it. We take a soldering iron to make our pots, and they'll go through about 5. One big hole down the center, just melt it through, maybe make a couple little ones on the side. That gets filled with a potting mix. The seeds go in it. That starts to sprout. Once they sprout, we add a little pinch to each one of mycorrhizal inoculation. Okay? That plant grows to a point where it's big enough and ready to go out in the garden. And at the same time, it's proper temperature. Like we've gotten to the time of year where we can plant it where it's not going to get killed by a frost. When we stick that plant in the ground, we have a 6-inch deep plug of compost, biochar, and biology that goes into the garden. Some point mid-season, we do a little addition of compost on the surface. We do about once every 3 weeks, we make compost extract. And we spray the plants in the evening. That's it. That's the whole thing. It's all integrated. It's impossible to screw it up now because we formulated it. It may not work that way for maybe you do Bokashi. Maybe you don't do bioreactor. I don't care what you do. But this is the tactics and the techniques linked together to the strategy. This is the way to think. And when you start thinking this way, it will change the dynamics and it won't be so much work anymore. Because, with the biochar, everybody talks about Terra Preta. And I think it's an amazing story. And to be honest with you guys, it's what got me hooked. It's when I went down the biochar rabbit hole. Like, I want to do this. But when I looked at it, I realized, like, these people could not have had the time or the technology to understand it from the viewpoint. I'm not going to say the level. From the viewpoint, through the lens that we do today. They had a lot of things to worry about, like not dying, like their enemies, their neighbors trying to kill them and take what they had. They had to be able to do this, to grow this food, to maintain these midden gardens without it being some big giant thing beyond just their daily activities. So they had to poop. They made clay pots. They put the clay pot over here that you pooped in, and they put the clay pot over there that you peed in. They had more clay than they knew what to do with. These were not beautiful clay pots. These were not like art pieces you would see in a museum somewhere, other than there's not so many left of them, right? But they're just crude pots anybody can make. So when it was full of poop and biochar, you threw it in the ground. You planted a tree into it. You planted an avocado pit into it. And when the pit got this big, you planted the whole pot in the ground, and it shattered. And that's why if you go and you look at a profile of Terra Preta, There's thousands of pottery shards, but if you really looked at them, if you went CSI, you could almost put them back together into the pot that they were before they shattered because they went in whole. This was an integrated, holistic process. We eat the food, we produce the waste, we care for the waste, we put the waste back into the system, and the system produces more food. This is how you have to think. If you want to be able to homestead, to be able to do regenerative ag, whatever, and actually feed yourself and your family. And let me say something, even you larger commercial scale producers, if you produce a ton of food and you sell it all, but you still go to the grocery store for almost everything you eat except the one or two crops you grow, what are you really doing? The producers should be able to feed themselves and their family first, their neighbors second, and then profit third. We're not able to do that in a world where you have to make money or you lose the farm outright. But it should be at least the goal, what the target is. And it can be incredibly profitable. Right now, for instance, there are young people in near Illinois that work with one of, I can't think of the guy's name now, but he works with Gabe Brown, except Gabe's out in the Dakotas. And this older gentleman who can't really farm the way he used to anymore basically has taken on the role of delivering product. And they're selling vegetables and things like that and fruits, et cetera, to restaurants in Chicago. He loads up this truck and trailer every week and takes orders and brings all the stuff. And it goes back. And there's some instances where, like, the farmer has, like, 1,100 acres. His kid doesn't want to not farm, but the farm can't produce enough for two incomes. So his little FHA product, the dad gives him an acre. And in a few years, he's making more money than his dad in actual money that he has to keep. Because he's selling a higher dollar product to a higher level customer. Now, that person could certainly feed themselves. So that's the mindset I want you to come at with this. Can you feed yourself, and can you do it without it being a hugely heroic effort to do so, where all you do is work in the garden every day? You can find my courses if you want to learn more from me. I have three courses available right now. I have one on composting. That's $40, and it's totally worth it. I've had some folks take it and say things like, well, I'll tell you, Billy Bond, who many of you guys would know, he took it, I gave it to him for free, and he said that he learned more in my $40 course than he did in a certain course on soils that cost $3,500. And I don't want to put anybody down or anything, but I'll just tell you that that's the case. I think part of that's the military aspect of what I talked about in the beginning with my teaching. Like, just drill it down to the things people need to know how to do and give it in a way that it actually can be done, right? I also have a cover crop course. That one's a lot more intensive. That one's $80. So both of them are very affordable. And you can find them at homefoodsystems.com. Then I have a principle-based permaculture design course. It's free. It's about a four-hour course. It has an exam. It's just like all the other courses, exam, certification, everything. I don't like secreting knowledge, but I also have to charge something for the work that I do, or I can't keep doing it like anybody. But I also think that if you're going to spend money with me, you should know what you're going to get. And sitting through one of my courses is a little different than sitting through a presentation because it's more tailored, it's more specific, it's designed to convey specific information and test you on the knowledge. So I thought it was important for us to have a free course. And that way you could try it out first. And then we have a biochar course that's coming by the latest early spring. It may officially still be, we may beat March 21. I'm hoping to do that. It's in development right now. Anyway, I also try to end my presentations almost always with this picture because I like to inspire people. Hopefully, we got my goal done. Hopefully, there's something you're going to do now that you wouldn't have done if you hadn't watched this, okay? But I don't want you to be fearful. Like, I don't know if I'll get this right. I can't take Jack's course right now. I want to go try this biochar thing, and I'm not ready yet. Just go do it. Be fearless and be a co-creator with life. Life wants to propagate. Life wants to grow. Life wants to live. Life is undefeated. It really is. Life is incredibly resilient. The picture you're looking at is a redwood that died. I don't know when. I don't know how. But we were in California a few years ago, my wife and I. She always wanted to see the redwoods, so we went. And where we stayed, there was a gentleman down the road from us a bit that we walked by his place a bunch that was logging out dead trees, trees that had fallen. He probably had a permit out there to be able to do it. And he was slab cutting them into these beautiful, huge slabs, these redwood slabs. This was a cutoff he had sitting out by his driveway. It looked almost like a rock, but it's actually a tree trunk. in the center of that tree trunk, that's a black spruce, a smaller cousin of the redwood, another conifer. And a seed from its cone landed in a crack in that redwood stump. And that little tree is eating the remains of that giant redwood. It will not be defeated. It will break that trunk down along with other biology. It will grow and it will probably live for a few hundred years, and it will die and it will contribute to the cycle and it will produce many young unless we cut them down. Nature wants to succeed. All you need to do is partner with it. And do not be afraid of the word co-creator, no matter what your spiritual or religious beliefs are. We were put here for a purpose. And to me, that purpose is so that we can extend life, that we can make more of it, and that we can become teachers, and we can create teachers. With that in mind, if there's a question you have about this presentation, if you would like my slide deck, if there's anything I can do for you, and you've watched this presentation, send me an email, jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com. Put TSPC space R soil is one word. That's this event that Matt's doing in the subject line. Give me your question in one sentence. Please do that for me, okay, before I overwhelm myself here. And then give me all the details you want, but give me the question first so I know what you're asking. If you do that, I will get back to you, I promise you. And again, if you want my deck from this presentation or any of my presentations you've ever seen, let me know. I don't know why some presenters are big on, like, I don't give my decks out. I believe that it is important for us to build and share knowledge. Thank you, Matt. I apologize for going over, but since it's pre-recorded, it shouldn't be much of a problem. So, guys, I hope you enjoyed that. Again, remember that you should check out the website today. You'll see a post on the site called Two Cool Workshops, Composting Cows, where you can come either to my half-day workshop here at Nine Mile Farm at the end of January, or toward the end of March, you can go up to Crunchy Mama Farms and learn how to process beef from, you know, snout to tail, from starting with a live cow all the way to a beautiful cooler full of grass-fed beef. Not a lot of opportunities to do something like that. And I promise you, you'll be with some of the coolest people that you'll ever meet. Me included, all right? I don't know if I'm the coolest person you'll ever meet, but I'll be there, and the other cool people will be there as well, including Chef Ken. I really hope to see many of you guys there, all 18 of you that can actually come. And again, the workshop here at the farm is going to be really awesome, half day, simple, easy thing, low cost, not a big time commitment. So either or, you can find it. And if you come to today's episode, you can, in the show notes, find a link to get over to the Our Soil Conference, which begins in earnest on Wednesday. You can hear from 40 amazing speakers. Pick and choose the one you want. If you want access to replays and things like that, go ahead and pony up the $40 or whatever it is. And anyway, I will catch you guys tomorrow. Tomorrow will be the first Tuesday of the full, you know, term back. And that means that we will have John Willis and Nicole Sauce in a live stream at 09:30, much earlier on a Tuesday. And we'll be talking about all the crazy shit that's gone on while we've been gone and all the crazy shit that's coming in the year 2025. And, you know, then we're kind of really backing at it. I thought we would be backing at it in normal mode today, but at least you got a new episode. Take care, guys. I'll catch you tomorrow.
They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.